Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're still covering the Constitution, but we're going, and it's not that we're trying to go through this slowly, folks. It's just that there are lots of little things and nuances that I appreciate the fact that Paul, welcome back, by the way, that Paul is pointing out for us, because the last time we were talking and the last thing we were going through was the Fourth Amendment, and you dialed into this open fields doctrine. So why don't you go ahead and kind of expound upon that?
So what I came across this quite by accident. Apparently there was a court case in which a farmer was found some cameras on his property. And upon further investigation, he discovered that some feds had put them there. And so he challenged this in court, and they came up with this thing called the Open Fields Doctrine. So you may be a property owner, but the court submits that your Fourth Amendment only applies to the area immediately around your house. So let's say you own 10 acres and you've got an area, you know, how do you define what's immediately around your house? But in your open field or in your forest, in your backyard, and I want to make sure I get this correct, that's not covered by the Fourth Amendment. According to this, let me look up these court cases. I may have sent them to you. But so your private property is still violated, because this open fields doctrine portends or puts out that.
Yeah. So I have the case right here. So let me kind of cut to the chase, because the court announced in Katz v. United States that the amendment protects people, not places, cast some doubt on the vitality of open fields principles, but all such doubts were cast away in Oliver v. United States, invoking Hester's reliance on the literal wording of the Fourth Amendment. Open fields are not effects. And distinguishing Katz, the court in Oliver ruled that the open fields exception applies to fields that are fenced and posted. The court held that an individual may not legitimately demand privacy for activities conducted out of doors in fields except in immediate areas surrounding the home. Now I'm here to say that this is just another case of where the court has actually redefined the Constitution. Now, there's merit, because I think you have a copy of it now. You have a copy of the Bill of Rights that Woody kind of did for us. And so you should actually look at, just search, do a word search for search and seizure, you know, just search and then do a, you know, for seizure and effects. If you just do a word search for those three words, you might find where they actually debated this. And there may have actually provided some clarity regarding the Fourth Amendment. But when one reads the Fourth Amendment, and we'll do this again, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses. Now, let me ask you this. Is house a property?
Of course it is.
Is your car your property?
Sure.
And if you buy a home and you buy it because it is something you are using, whether it be the woods that you use for whatever you decide to use that property for, like cutting down wood, growing food, letting cattle graze, what have you, is that not property?
Of course it is.
So in other words, if a corporation, you know, decides to do farming, or a corporation decides to do something on their land, Are they saying that a corporation is immune from, you know, the constitutional protections of their own property rights? I doubt that. And as a matter of fact, when it comes down to unreasonable searches and seizures, and as a matter of fact, when it comes down to keeping track, I mean, the whole point of being able to, because does it say phone? And clearly, it doesn't say phone in the Constitution.
Correct.
But somehow we actually have a protection because they found that monitoring phones would come into a search or see, you know, listening in. It doesn't say listening in, but the courts somehow at least, you know, realized that when a person has the expectation of privacy. See, I actually agree with the court's position regarding your trash can. If you take your trash and you put it out on the street, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. And so just like, you know, with the phones and so forth, so you want to expound? This is my beautiful bride, so I'm going to just take this real quick. But go ahead and expound on this, Paul.
Okay. Well, that's, Jared, that gives us some clarity. Of course, when you put your trash out, you're disclaiming access to it because they're going to come and pick it up. But if it's not trash, then it's you still have a claim to it. And so certainly that, you know, you have that expectation. I would have the expectation of privacy on anything that I would own, whether it's my phone, whether it's inside my car, in my house, and whether it's on property that I own. And so it sounds to me like you're saying that you read deeper into the case, that it covers you, your property, if it's fenced. But I'm not even sure that's what's meant. I'd have to look that up, and maybe GR that you have looked that up more closely. And so it's an alarming doctrine, I believe, and it is something that, you know, deserves a better look. But I don't think that was the intention of the framers. No, they owned many of them owned thousands of acres, right? And so and their honor of people at the time respected the boundaries of what that acreage may be,
right,
or what your property was. They were common, you know. In other words, you know, your rights end at the boundary of where someone else's rights begin. And so what gives the government more rights than the people? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it's really comes down to like what I said in redefining. Oh, well, that's your property, but you really don't have any right to keep us out of it. You know, the only thing you have a right to keep us out of is that, you know, that little 2-foot strip around the outside of your house. Are you kidding me?
Right.
But again, the contrast is, oh, but you're going to respect the privacy of my phone calls that actually go across the wire, you know, to, you know, somewhere else in the city or somewhere else in the state or in the nation.
Right.
Well beyond my property. Right. I mean, so it just doesn't fly. You know, how can they honor our right of privacy or the expectation of privacy? And
well,
they
actually not honoring our expectation of privacy, but go ahead.
So I'm not sure, because it doesn't really say if this – did this go to the Supreme Court?
I think it did. Hang on just a minute. Let me see. Court of Appeals.
There's a total of 8 cases here.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure where I see this actually going in front of the Supreme Court. But then again, it only goes to the Supreme Court if there's an appeal, right?
Right. And okay. I'm looking sent. So this is okay. I see there's an Oregon Supreme Court, Vermont Supreme Court, You know what? I'm not seeing.
Right. Nor am I.
I'm not a U.S. Supreme Court case. So right. It maybe it hasn't gone there yet.
Right. And so the 9 times out of 10, when it comes to possibly taking back or releasing power that the federal government has usurped, 9 times out of 10, they don't like doing that. 9 times out of 10, especially in these days where government's control and desire over us is insatiable. So there we have it. But folks, just because we understand property, that you have this expectation. In other words, I guess you have to have enough affluence and money to be able to create a wall. Now, see, I understand. I completely understand, especially this goes down to a conversation. Sorry for speaking in sentence fragments, but this really goes down to a conversation that states need to have, and the states need to really define this. And so because the Fourth Amendment does give you your privacy and your rights of your privacy. The question is, you know, can you buy up 40 pieces of property around the United States and expect the same level of privacy regardless of where you go?
Mm. I found it, GR.
Go ahead.
Hester versus United States.
Okay, so that was the one that actually went to the Supreme Court? And what court was that? Is with the Warren Court?
Here's what it says. It says opinion written by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. So this is 1924.
Okay, so this is back when the progressive era, correct, okay.
The court held the special protection accorded by the Fourth Amendment to the people in their persons, houses, papers, and effects is not extended to the open fields. So this is this decision is almost 100 years old.
Yeah. So they're calling it open fields instead of the person's property.
Correct.
See, to me, an open field is somebody else's property. An open field is no man's land. And so this is the language, and this was a progressive court. This is during the progressive era when the court really started swinging more and more and more towards this, what I'll just call this progressive era. And so anyway, let me kind of move on. I want to get back to what I was saying. I believe the states really need to have a conversation because we're living in a day and age where there are people that have a level of affluence that can buy up large pieces of property and actually commit economic warfare. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is when Bill Gates or a nation or what have you buys up farmland and refuses to use that land for farming, refuses to use it at all, they basically shutter it. They basically shut it down and say, this is now unproductive land, and it will become a potential dust field.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, remember the when we learned in history about, you know, the dust fields of Kansas when the drought and everything else got so bad. And so a state has every right and every interest to kind of protect those types of things from happening. And so I honestly see that a person's property rights, especially if that is your primary property, needs to be fully respected. But if it is not your primary property, and it is property that is considered a resource of revenue for the state where actually farming can be done on it, and you just bought it as an investment, then the state should, because they should actually fairly lease that from you. But I believe that there should be, you know, but it's a fair lease. In other words, it can't be a lease to where you can actually become an hindrance towards farming to say, oh, well, we're going to treat this like a $1 million home and you have to rent it, you know, for thousands of dollars for, you know, for square foot or something. And, you know, that's just not reasonable. it's farmland, and the cost of the land, they should already have a median or a some, you know, average of what farmland costs and the property value and so forth. And therefore, what they can do is actually they can apply the property taxes, you know, to that person, and or actually waive those property taxes and lease that land so that the farmer next door can come in or somebody else can come in and use that land so that, one, it maintains its durability and usability, as well as it provides revenue to the state. But when they come in and correct, they actually create blight, that's economic warfare. Mm-hmm. And the states should actually draw a line and say, we're not allowing anybody to conduct any form of economic warfare in our state. We're not, we consider correct, that hostile, and we're going to come after you. Right. So there we go. So anyway, this also goes down to the same thing with opulent people that buy these really expensive homes way out in the woods and, you know, Colorado, Montana, it doesn't matter where it is. You know, when they buy up 100 acres and then they expect to have all of the services, you know, you do realize that when you live in these large swath ranches and to be able to have a fire and or police or any type of public services, then, I mean, that costs a lot of money. And so there needs to be a re-evaluation of non-primary residents for out-of-state residents who own and buy land and actually just suck up land. This would force them to actually make smaller properties. Either that or they pay through the nose for property tax. Because all they're doing is buying up this beautiful resort, and they should be paying what a resort would be paying on that property tax.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, you know, because we have to actually start looking at, you know, whether, you know, we are here for the opulent in society or whether we're here to coexist and be productive and give everybody equal opportunity. It's not necessarily about equality per se. It is about ensuring that people cannot oppress others.
Correct.
And actually, the rich are really, really good at shifting the burden so that the middle class and other, you know, the poor, the minions actually have to suck up and pay. And, you know, what are we, stupid? So, anyway, this is not about communism or socialism. This is about, you know, protecting the property of the other people, because somebody has to pay the taxes to put that fire department over there.
Sure.
Right. Anyway, moving on. We're at the Article 5, or I should say this is Article 7 or the Fifth Amendment.
Right.
And so, okay, go ahead.
Amendment 5. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or other... Otherwise, infamous crime unless under presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in active actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Okay. Got a lot of highlights here.
Yeah, so there's a lot of highlights. So technically, the, you know, one of the things that, you know, really stands out is no person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime. So there's lots of people that are, but the real point is that they are being held without the presentment or an indictment of a grand jury. Now, why is the fact that they've bypassed the grand jury? I mean, when they're looking for somebody that has, you know, the potential, you know, murder suspect, and they go, oh, we've got the person. They handcuff him and they take him in and they charge him because they have already acquired the evidence and so forth. Was that done by a grand jury?
Well, so
I mean, let's look at all of these different manhunts and so forth. I mean, just recently there was a gentleman that, you know, got caught for doing, you know, some serial killing or, you know, killing people, had people buried on his property or what have you. There's a couple of cases that have recently just happened. In any of those cases, were those cases brought forward due to an indictment of a grand jury?
I don't know. I don't know the cases. They may or may not have been. So what happens
is a prosecuting attorney will actually, and the DA will actually, you know, push with, you know, getting evidence and so forth. And when they have enough evidence, they actually dispense with the constitutional right of having a grand jury determine whether you should actually be tried for trial, go for trial. Now, go ahead.
So I've served on a grand jury, and it was an interesting piece of work because I didn't even know how important it was. I remember they wanted to charge someone with arson, and we listened to the prosecution's case, and we didn't think he had enough evidence. And he walked away without a, you know, walked away without a charge. But here's the question that's bothering me. Let's say maybe a murder is committed and they quickly apprehend somebody. Now, while they're holding this person, they still have to have a grand jury. Okay. Now, this person hasn't answered for capital or otherwise infamous crime. But while they're being held, a grand jury has to meet and see the evidence before the person can be charged. Does that make sense? Is that a gray area?
Now, so what they do, because how many times do they actually arrest somebody and hold them in jail without bail? Because technically, you're right, there's the arrest. But when it comes down to infamous crimes, you know, because if we look at... Let's go down this little path of, because I'm going to jump forward. When we look at the Eighth Amendment, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Now, if you haven't been convicted and you, let's say, you know, drunk driving.
Okay.
And so you haven't been convicted of a crime. There's some evidence that they've gathered or what have you. And the judge basically says, well, you know, we're going to assume that you're guilty. And we lay this bail upon you that is. So what's excessive? This goes back to the fundamental question of, you know, what may be excessive for one person is not excessive at all for another person. And I get that we want to have a significant bail for somebody that has done something. But when you tell me that a 20-year-old baseball player who got drunk and actually had an accident and walks in, you know, and, you know, gets booked and then walks right out because, you know, obviously they know he has the money. They're just going to write a check as soon as the bank opens or what have you. But he really doesn't spend any time in jail. And that a 20-year-old kid who's a carpenter who may have had an accident, we're going into break here, but may have had an accident just as well. And because of his driving, his drunk driving, and they give him the same kind of bail, which actually decimates him and decimates his family. How is that you know, how can that not be excessive? It may not be excessive to one, but it definitely can be excessive to another. So when we come back, I'll talk more about this when we come back. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what I was just saying, and hopefully this makes sense, what's excessive to one person may not be excessive at all. I mean, it may, literally may be nothing. As a matter of fact, when you look in the magnitude of somebody's wealth and their income, and they're making millions of dollars, you know, as a starting, you know, uprising kid, and they're out there celebrating, and, you know, they wreck their car, you know, compared to some other person that maybe didn't even wreck their car, but it doesn't matter. They are, I mean, here's somebody that actually was that drunk that they wrecked their car, but somebody that might be some kid, like I said, that got promoted or what have you, and maybe celebrated and, you know, crossed the line, didn't even come close to that, but was still caught by the police because of circumstances. And regardless of how they get caught, how is that not excessive when the bail amount exceeds what that person makes in a year? In contrast to that not even being a fraction, I mean, a reasonable fraction of what this other person makes in a year. Does that make sense? Paul, you might still be muted, but in case you aren't muted...
I was still muted. I'm sorry.
We came it's okay. Break. It's okay.
No, I understand what you're saying. So what you're suggesting is maybe there should be a proportional requirement as opposed to, you know, a fixed requirement. Because for one person, it may be nothing. And for another person, it might be a year's wages.
Right. So right. Absolutely. Or a several years wage.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Because it all depends on, you know, where you are in your stage of life. Let's say, you know, you're in the military and you're literally living a poverty level and they've mistaken you for somebody else and they've arrested you. And this goes back to the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime. And this goes back to bail. Let's just say they've confused you and, you know, it's not like you're a flight risk if you're in the military. I mean, you know, not that you can't be a flight risk, but the point is that, you know, you can't have excessive bail. You can't have this whole holding somebody, because what ends up happening if you can't afford the bail? If you don't, right. You know, if this, I've seen this actually happen when somebody had a 20,000, you know, or actually 100,000. Believe it or not, you look at some of the crimes today, it's $100,000 bail and you have to come up with what, 10 or 20% of that. And that's almost impossible for, you know, people of no income or very little income, especially, you know, I'll just say those who are on a fixed income or those who are just starting off. And let's say, okay, you know, you You already started off kind of young, starting off with the family. You graduate from high school, and you got one and you know one kid or two already. And we're looking at a point. How is this person, because they couldn't afford bail? How are they not being held to answer for a capital crime without that right. grand jury?
Correct.
So, in other words, even though these two things are separate, they're entwined. There's no way that they arrested that person for that infamous crime with the grand jury indictment. They basically arrest the person, and if they're going to go get a grand jury indictment, then that comes after the fact, before they actually have trial to determine. But not, there are cases where they even bypass the grand jury, and that. Got to remember that our whole system was designed to basically guarantee that it is far better for a guilty man to go free than an innocent man to go to jail. And that has completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
For it's okay for innocent men to go to jail because, you know, there's no way anybody that could potentially be guilty will ever walk the streets again. And then we look and we turn right around and we see the progressives actually releasing violent criminals and so forth without even serving their time. So we look at and we hear today how we have like a multi-tiered legal system. You know, people say, oh, well, the politicians, it's not just politicians, folks. It is anybody that reaches an opulent status where they can just write that check. You do know that most people that have money do not pay for car insurance.
Most people that have money do not pay for car insurance.
That's absolutely correct, because they don't need to. They don't need to pay for car insurance. All they have to do is be able to put up a bond that will cover a certain amount of money for whatever the liability of that state is.
So here's a question. They put up the bond, they have an accident,
mm-hmm.
and so aren't they responsible for...
It doesn't mean that they're not responsible, but that goes through the court process. You have to prove that they're responsible, right? The investigation, all of that. But all you have to do is have a bond that says, yep, I've got this bond, that, and, you know, it's $50,000, $100,000, which is nothing. And it actually can sit out there and collect interest for them without having to pay an insurance company. I'm surprised you did not know this. Most people that have that level of money, they don't pay for an insurance, because unless they're really, really reckless. I mean, like, you know, these stars that go out and get drunk and so forth. But people that I know that have had affluence that didn't pay, you know, they didn't actually pay for their insurance on their vehicles. They just had a bond. And I mean, that way their money stayed in their bank account and collected interest instead of actually paying a company to cover them, because some of their cars were pretty expensive to cover.
Sure, they are.
Yeah.
So okay. No, I wasn't aware of that. I guess I haven't reached that level of affluence.
Yeah, and you know what? There's some people that don't even know that. As a matter of fact, I happen to know one guy who, you know, was very successful in the tech industry, and he actually, you know, it took him a while before somebody finally told him that, you know, you don't need to pay for insurance with the amount of money you've got. Oh, I didn't know that. And, you know, then he started bragging about that because he's a kid.
Sure, it's actually, I think the laws has to do with financial responsibility. So if you don't have insurance, are you financially able?
Well, it's not really responsibility. It is that you have the financial backing. You can because the whole point of insurance, I-N-S-U-R, is underwriting. In other words, somebody that says, I have the money to back this guy if he causes damage. So you have to be able to underwrite yourself via that bond. That's what
right.
I-N-S-U-R, insurer, means. It's about underwriting. So versus insure, making sure of. Anyway, all right. So the other part of this is double jeopardy. And that's actually happened where there's been cases that, you know, a person didn't even know they were tried twice. They, you know, went to jail and come to find out somebody said, hey, and, you know, that's always a, you know, a nice surprise, especially for the guilty person that went to jail.
Right.
But the last part of this is probably the most important. Nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, we were just talking about private property being used but not taken.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you're not going to grow on it, you have a certain point in time, and you're, you know, if you're committed to not growing or you have failed to use that land, then at that point, the state would basically say, okay, we're leasing this. And at that point, you'd have to say, okay, no, I'm just a little bit late. We're going to be sowing next week. If they fail to do that, then they can't, they should be, this, the state should actually fine them, especially if they play these, the stonewalling games, and then lease it and let somebody go in and do, you know, maybe a little bit later planting and harvesting, but still. It is utilizing and keeping that land vital, both in revenue as well as in the environment, because the worst thing you can do is just let blight take over your agricultural area. Kansas can tell you all about that. But the most important part is when they actually do this forfeiture, when a government comes in and they say, you committed a crime, and now we're going to deprive you of your property and take your property for you because you use that property in the commission of a crime. Now, it says right here, nor shall private property be taken. It, you know, there's no, well, unless you committed a crime and you used that property. It doesn't say that, does it?
Right.
Okay. So... So when we see asset forfeiture, when we see the local law enforcement, sheriffs or what have you doing asset forfeiture, and they're coming in and taking your property, you should turn right back around and present them with a bill. This is the just compensation for taking my property. In other words, let's say you're actually facing a trial. And, you know, they've taken your car or what have you, then you should be able to just say, okay, here's the bill for that, and that'll pay for my lawyer defense or what have you. And then okay. If I get off, then I get my car back. And you don't get, you know, that, well, actually, you'll basically sue for the lawyer bill at that point. But you know, 9 times out of 10, lawyers don't defend you for free. So... So my point is that we actually have a huge protection that is being violated, especially with the forfeit or asset forfeiture laws that they've instilled today. And I think most people get this, but it's an indictment of how tyrannical our government has become, because there's just no way the framers would have stood for this, especially with what we're dealing with. Anything else on the Fifth Amendment or anything that you wanted to bring up?
No, you covered a lot of it, GR.
Okay, all right.
See if anything else here. No, I think that these asset forfeiture is almost, I have to add, it's almost like this asset forfeiture thing has almost become like a business. And
yes.
When I say business, police organizations want to do this. They obtain property this way, and that's not the way it's supposed to work.
Okay, that's right, and it's not. And as a matter of fact, it does become a huge crutch for a slush fund for both the police, the city, the state, or what have you, which is why it gets done. Usually if it's done at a local level, that means it's being done all the way up to the state level because the state has opened those doors. Now, the Sixth Amendment. There's a few different, really distinct things here. So if you want to kind of take it by, you know, by sentence structure, we can cover it that way.
Okay. Okay. So let's do that. Amendment 6. Uh-huh. In all criminal prosecutions, right?
Right.
The accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial.
Stop. So right. Does the prosecution have a right to enjoy a speedy and public trial? Does the prosecution have a right, based on what you read, you know, does the government have a right to basically, you know, have a trial? They book you and have a trial the next day. Can they?
It says the accused. It doesn't say the prosecution. It says the accused.
Okay. Well, right. Why am I bringing this up?
Okay. Well, probably going back to the Fifth Amendment, the prosecution may be speedy if they skip an indictment of a grand jury.
Well, there's that. Example, yes, there's right? that. Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's say that there has been a grand jury and an indictment has come forward, and that indictment basically has, you know, issued a warrant. The person's been, you know, basically booked, or I should say, you know, the warrant goes out, the person comes in and goes through the arrest process and booked and actually then pays their bail, because at that point, I can understand, because there's been an indictment, now we can have bail. Because this is, and actually we've just witnessed the past few months, this actually just happening, where, you know, there was a grand jury, the grand jury issued an indictment, and basically the prosecutor then announced that this person was going to be arrested and a bench warrant, and that person then turned themselves in and then was booked and paid their bail and then walked free. And here's the question. Okay, so now you're booking me. Do I have a right to a speedy trial, or does the prosecution have a right to set the pace of the trial? In other words, who has control over the pace of the trial based on the Fifth Amendment?
Well, this is the accused.
There you go.
To a speedy and public trial.
Okay, so it has a right. So, you know, shall enjoy the right. Let's say the accused waives that right and says, I want to do full discovery. I want time to do this. Then I don't have to worry about a speedy trial, especially if I've paid my bail. I can understand somebody who hasn't paid bail, and it's pretty a simple case of, you know, your word against somebody else, something like that, where a speedy trial, let's just get this over with. But if you're dealing with something like what Trump is dealing with, where did the prosecution get off in setting the pace of how they wanted to prosecute him?
Well, so the accused has a right to his defense. And so he or she ought to have those tools that will allow him to mount a reasonable defense.
Yes.
Which means it may take time.
Yes. Yes, okay? Absolutely.
So I can see that it doesn't make – it's not in the interest of justice to push the accused – who, by the way, the accused is innocent until proven guilty, pushed the accused into an inadvantageous position.
Right. So here's the thing, right? I mean, there are reasons why prosecutions want to be able to control, because they use either a lack of evidence or a lack of time to gather evidence and gather a defense so that they can basically come in for the kill quickly because they've got you in a corner. Or, you know, they know that, you know, giving you more time will actually, you know, help your case possibly. But bottom line, it says that the right of a speedy trial is only granted to the accused. And therefore, the accused has every right to say, hold on here, I do not need a speedy trial. As a matter of fact, what I need is, because you've had a grand jury do this huge investigation behind these closed doors, I need the same amount of time. How long did that grand jury bake and stew? And as a matter of fact, it's only reasonable, if you ask me, to say I need more time because I don't have the power of a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
The grand jury, if they actually subpoena something, boom, they get what they want. Having the burden on the prosecution to have that same kind of authority is not there. And so my point is that, you know, we've actually seen how this has actually become perverted. As I stated before, our system was based on it is far better for guilty men to go free than an innocent man to go to jail. And so the whole point is protecting and ensuring the innocence of that person that could potentially be incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't lend to giving prosecution advantages or allowing the prosecution to dictate. And there's just no doubt in my mind that this is all being done politically. And I just can't understand why nobody is actually standing up and saying, hey, hold on here. You know, that this is my right, not yours. And you went through, like I said, I can't understand why his legal team has failed to make these arguments.
Because they don't know the Constitution.
Possibly.
Here's the other thing, Gier, and oftentimes, let me put it this way, it's kind of indelicate. Americans don't read deeply enough.
Uh-huh.
So we've heard Amendment 6. Right to a speedy trial, and you can at first blush assume, hey, that means your trial needs to go through the court system as fast as it can. Well, no, it doesn't, because you just pointed out the accused ought to be able to set the pace of his or her defense.
Yep.
Okay. So you have a right to a speedy trial. That means, you know, you don't need to be incarcerated for an unreasonable amount of time if you can't do bail. On the other hand, you have a right to all of the tools you need to maintain your innocence. And I didn't say prove your innocence. You have to prove you are guilty.
Right. That's correct.
So that's what occurs to me is that we tend to what's in the mindset of the American public is they don't know. We're not reading the Constitution deeply. And so that what clicks in the head is right to a speedy trial in and out of the court system as fast as you can. No, that's not the intention. Thank you for pointing that out.
Right. All right. So the next thing is this. Go ahead and read this next. Take us out to the semicolon, because it's kind of this is kind of entwined. There's a few different, I'll just say, twists to this, but go ahead and take us out by an impartial jury out to the accusation. Go ahead.
All right. So by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation.
Okay. So when somebody is actually, you know, going to be standing trial, the location of the trial shall be by an impartial jury of the state. In other words, it's the jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. Now, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law and to be informed of the name. And so the accused has a right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. Okay.
Correct.
So when we look at how this all went down, and I'm just using Trump as a great example, was the crime committed? Where was the crime committed?
They claim the crime was committed in New York.
Well, okay. Let's just break away the New York one, because I do understand the Georgia case. The Georgia case is, you know, there was a phone call.
Oh, and, in that case.
Right? There was a phone call basically threatening Kemp to you need to do these things, right? So where was that crime really committed?
Well, it was a crime committed in Georgia or where the call originated.
Ah, see, there you go. And actually, what was the crime? The nature of the crime? The nature of the crime was regarding the national election.
Right.
Which means that it wasn't just in Atlanta, Georgia. It was the entire state of Georgia, as well as the entire United States. Because let me ask you this. How many Georgia votes or ballots came from out of state?
Or shouldn't have been any.
You don't have absentee ballots and votes in Georgia like everybody else does?
Sure they do.
Okay.
Sure
they do. You see my point?
Right.
Okay. So if it's about verifying all of the ballots, and when you start looking at the details and you start saying, well, where was that crime committed?
Huh. Right.
Okay. So I believe because now you've got, these are all over the election, right? The New York trial is a little bit different, correct? It's a,
it's a financial.
Yeah, structure. But I think that doesn't he have two or three indictments from grand juries regarding the election?
Yes.
So this is my point to, why his legal team didn't do this. There's no reason why he can't have these cases adjoined, and there's no reason why he can't seek a fair trial because overall, on these cases over the election, I understand that this other indictment in New York is somewhat different, which is why I'm not really dealing with that. But I do know that when it comes down to the election was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And if Trump made phone calls, to other places, it doesn't really matter. What really matters is his right to have an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. And if his crime was really a national crime that you could actually say, was everywhere. But see, here's the thing. It's going to come down to this. What actual crime did he commit? Even if I called you and said, I want you, it doesn't matter. If I sent troops with guns and basically said, either you do this or these guys will execute you. That's a crime. That it's almost like taking a fist and holding it in your face. That right there is assault.
Right.
But
I hear your question. Okay. What is the crime that he's guilty of?
Right. And so can a president actually go holler and yell and demand that, these governors do their job in ensuring that the election is fair and do an audit and make sure that, that there hasn't been any foul play in their election?
Of course he can. And not only that.
We just ran out of time. I hate to say it, folks. Unfortunately, Paul is rambling on, and because nine times out of ten, something he doesn't realize we're at this point. We're going to have to take this back up because I think this is a very important conversation. Where was the crime committed? And, what is it that, Trump really did? And how is that a crime? Anyway, we will be back tomorrow. I'm GR Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.